Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff. My name is Gretchen Miller. Today we're going to start off with something from Christine Ha from theblindcook.com. In honor of International Women's Day, this was back in 2019, GoPro shares my culinary journey. Sometime back in 2017 or 18, the Hubs submitted this YouTube video of me showing what it's like to cook without sight for a GoPro award, and there is a link at theblindcook.com. Though we didn't win, something even better happened. GoPro came to Houston and shot the above video with us, chronicling my culinary journey from being a blind home cook to winning MasterChef Season 3, and now to becoming chef and owner of my very first restaurant, The Blind Goat. The video was released on Monday in a series leading up to International Women's Day, which is today, on March 8th, a while ago, a celebration of women all over the planet. Thank you, GoPro, for the amazing video, and to read more about the backstory behind the collab, visit GoPro's blog post. You can follow The Blind Goat on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Next, from The Blind Kitchen, how to cook ground meat perfectly every time. Cooking ground meats to be sure they're fully cooked and not overcooked can be tricky for a blind or visually impaired person. Here are a few steps to make sure ground meat is cooked perfectly every time. Some common recipes that call for ground meat to be browned are tacos, chilies, and sausage gravy. If you are browning ground beef, it generally contains enough fat that no more needs to be added. If cooking ground chicken, turkey, or pork, or lean ground beef, adding fat to the pan is important to be sure that the meat does not stick to the pan as it cooks. Most recipes do not call for crusty meat crumbles. For each pound of ground meat, I add 1 tablespoon of plant oil, such as vegetable oil or olive oil, and you can use my auto measure spout for that. The oil will not affect the finished taste of the meat, so a less expensive oil is fine. Cooking steps. Number 1. Add the oil to the bottom of a cold pan if your meat requires added fat to cook nicely. Use a paper towel to spread a thin layer of oil all over the bottom of the cold pan. It will be helpful to use a flat bottom high-sided sauté pan. I like a pan with at least 3-inch walls, straight, not sloped, because it helps keep the food in the pan better than its sloped counterpart, where food can travel more easily up the sloped side and find its way out of the pan. Step number 2. For any ground meat that you're using, it's important to break up any chunks of meat as you put it into the cold pan. Clumps of meat will take longer to cook, and they're more difficult to break up during the cooking process after the pan is hot. You can't see it and you can't feel it, so breaking it up before you turn on the heat can avoid this problem. Also, if your ground meat is different sizes, it will cook at different rates, with the larger chunks taking more time to cook than the smaller pieces, so the little pieces will be overdone before the larger chunks are done. Consistency in size is key. Assessing the temperature of the meat. Even with the use of a talking thermometer, it's impossible for this task because the pieces are so small. For most recipes that involve the browning of ground meat, such as tacos or chili, the meat will be cooked further as the recipe progresses, so cooking it fully the first pass is less essential, even if it's ground chicken or turkey. Step number 3, after the meat is evenly distributed in the pan, turn the heat on to medium to allow the pan to heat up quickly. Take a moment while the pan is warming to smell the raw meat and keep it in mind as you continue. The smell of cooked meat is dramatically different than raw meat, and you can use your nose to help determine doneness. Step number 4, choose a utensil to move the hot food around. I use a long wood spoon, but any heat-resistant wood or silicone utensil of your choice is fine. The blind-friendly considerations in choosing this tool is to make sure it has a long handle so that the tool is not able to fall down into the bottom of the pan. The other consideration is that the tool should not be made of a material that conducts heat, such as stainless steel. This allows the tool to remain in the pan for the entirety of the cooking process and eliminates the need to move the tool in and out of the pan, reducing the chance of dripping or food waste from moving it in and out of the pan. Step number 5, when you hear the meat start to sizzle, turn the heat to medium low. The small pieces will cook quickly and only a slight sizzle is necessary to cook the ground meat thoroughly. If you hear anything louder than a slight sizzle, the heat is too high and the contents of the pan will need to be cooled as quickly as possible. The fastest way to do this is to lift the pan up and off the heat source until the sound dies down, and then it can be placed back on the heat source and can continue to cook using less high heat. Silence is not desirable either. You need to hear a slight, constant sizzle to be able to use the timing guide in the next step. Step 6. A pound of ground meat at a medium-low temperature will take about 6 to 9 minutes, depending on the temperature and the thickness of the pan and the temperature of the meat when it's placed in the pan. Move or stir the meat for about 30 seconds for every minute that it cooks so that no morsel of meat is in constant contact with the bottom of the pan for the entire cooking time. Any meat that is not moved will burn or crust in that amount of time. You will be able to smell the cooked meat when it's done. As it will probably be cooked further when making the dish, this timing guide will certainly result in a fully cooked, pleasantly textured, and colored product. Step number 7. If your meat needs to be drained, I find it's most efficient to leave the cooked meat in the pan off of the heat source. Allow it to cool enough to be touched, but not cool enough to allow the cooked animal fat to return to a solid state. Tilt the pan slightly and place a wad of clean paper towels where gravity is pulling the liquid fat to gather, and allow the towel to soak up the unwanted fat. This method eliminates the need for a strainer and another greasy dish to clean. The unpleasant task of getting hot meat to fall into the strainer and the greasy sink that will need to be cleaned after the meat is drained, so this is effective and efficient. Note, if you want to save the grease for another purpose, such as bacon grease, you can use the blind-friendly side strainer, which easily removes any food particles, resulting in clean grease that can be stored for use at a later time. Next, also from the Blind Kitchen, cooking with tea bags. Do you know there are literally thousands of tea bag flavors, including herbs and spices? Some, like lavender and mint teas, you are probably familiar with, but there are so many more. I use flavored tea bags to infuse flavor when I am boiling, simmering, and poaching. Some of the lesser known tea flavors are oregano, thyme, star anise, and celery seed tea bags. These tea bags are quick to access, do not require measuring, and are easy to retrieve as I just tie the string of the bag to the handle of the pan that I'm cooking in. Tea bag ideas. An oregano tea bag or two in pasta water so that when the pasta absorbs the salted water, it's also getting a hint of oregano. A mint tea bag in the rice cooker adds a delicate hint of mint. That sounds really yummy. A star anise tea bag in an orange sauce for shrimp adds an interesting hint of licorice. And I don't even like licorice, but it works for this purpose. A lemongrass tea bag or two when I'm poaching fish or eggs adds a subtle but distinctive special touch. You can learn more about how to cook with tea from this article from masterclass.com, and there's a link at theblindkitchen.com, cooking-with-teabags, in between the tea and the bags. Next steps, theblindkitchen.com offers adaptive tools, helpful strategies, and specialized knowledge to blind and visually impaired people who want to cook safely, confidently, and independently. Our collections are available online, as are our short instructional videos. Shipping is always free, and everyone has a place at the table in the Blind Kitchen. Next, we're going to do a recipe from smittenkitchen.com for cream cheese noodle kugel. Considering that my parents will celebrate the 40th anniversary of their first date this weekend, it seems only appropriate to use today shed light on a certain farce. My mother did not marry my father for his flamenco guitar. his ability to use a hammer and a nail, or his promises to love her for the next hereafter. Nope, she married him because when she asked his aunt for the recipe to her delicious noodle kugel, she was told she couldn't have it until she married my father. And so it was. And you might think this story cruel or careless, but really, Mother has been telling me and my sister this our whole lives, and my father seems not in the least offended. I only married him for that noodle kugel recipe, she says. And everyone nods and smiles because, well, they've heard it a zillion times before, but also because the kugel is just that good. So what's the question? So why haven't I told you about it before? I mean, do we need to count how many Jewish holidays have passed in the last year during which I just failed to mention that? By the way, I have a recipe for noodle kugel so good people will give up their singlehood just to have unfettered access to it. Well, I haven't told you about it because, and I suspect that on this, if no other part of the story, that you'll follow me. It's Mom's recipe. It's what Mom makes. Why would I make it? It's her thing. Except, this is the really shameful part. I'm not proud. I almost wish I could take it back and pretend that it never happened, and we could have just continued the way things were. And yet, 2 weeks ago, Alex and I went to Balducci's to pick up some things for dinner, and on the way out, I tried a sample that they were handing out of their noodle kugel from their high holiday menu, and it was so good. I almost offered to marry the guy giving it out just for the recipe, but I was torn because I already have a kick-ass kugel recipe, and oh right, yeah, I'm also already married. But I couldn't stop thinking about its cream cheesiness and the tartness of the dried cherries, and while it was not better than what I know, because there are no betters, just difference, when it comes to family heirloom recipes, I had to try to recreate it at home. Thus, it is with a heavy and stereotypically guilt-ridden heart that I tell you that this adapted kugel recipe is awesome. Like, really, really good. And though I feel like I've gone against the family or something fixing what was not broken, I suspect that there are people out there whose existences did not come to pass because of the original kugel recipe that might enjoy this newfangled one. You don't even have to marry anyone to get it. Right? So, noodle kugel. Here's the recipe. The truth is, I didn't change that much. I used less butter, switched to the salted stuff, swapped cottage for cream cheese, and added dried cherries. Fine, that's a lot. But you see, even tradition is forgiving to adaptation. Who knew? You'll need 1 pound of wide egg noodles, 2 8-ounce packages of cream cheese, softened, 1 pound or 16 ounces of creamed cottage cheese, full fat, 1.5 cups of sugar, 1 stick of salted butter, melted, plus more for greasing the baking dish, 8 eggs, 2 teaspoons of vanilla, 1 teaspoon cinnamon, and 1 cup dry cherries. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Grease a 9x13 glass baking dish. Parboil the noodles 5 to 7 minutes and then drain them in a colander. In a very large bowl, beat the cream cheese until fluffy. Add cottage cheese and beat for another minute. Scrape the bowl down well. Add the sugar and combine, and then the melted butter, and scrape down the bowl another time. Add the eggs one at a time, beating between additions. Add the cinnamon, vanilla, and mix, and then stir in the dried cherries. And finally, carefully mix in the drained egg noodles. Pour into a prepared baking dish and bake for 1 hour before checking to see if the center is set. It may need up to 30 minutes more. Yes, I know that this range is crazy, but I baked kugels that took either end of the range, and they refused to be predictable. We're going to have another recipe from smittenkitchen.com for strawberries and dumplings. Have you met my favorite chicken and dumpling dish? Well, let me introduce you to its sweet summer fling, strawberries and dumplings, or in this case, strawberries so tiny one took a nap inside a soda cap and dumplings so plump they nudged and piled upon one another like newborn puppies. Yes, in case that didn't give it away, the cuteness of this dish nearly killed me dead. I caught this dessert of the month from gourmet.com last week, and I knew it had to be ours. I won't lie, as soon as it becomes remotely summery around here, I spend more of my time scheming ways to avoid cooking than I do actually fixing things. Quick stewed strawberries with an easy dough scooped on top, sold to the laziest bidder. I am endlessly entertained by baked fruit desserts, and frankly, the goofier the name, the better. Peach slumps and blueberry buckles and apple betties and pear pandowdies. Searching around, it seems like this type of dumpling topping most closely resembles a grunt, teehee, although I understand this is technically no different than a slump. Though about half the grunt recipes I looked at also include an egg, and all of them suggested that you bake them in the oven, not on the stove. Still, the resemblances are there, a soft dumpling plopped on gurgling fruit to make a quick, no-fuss, homey dessert. And how much fun will it be to tell your friends that they're getting a grunt for dessert? Here's the recipe for strawberries and dumplings, adapted wildly from Gourmet. Being difficult, or being me, I changed a whole lot of things about the original recipe. It sounded like it would be way too sweet, especially for my market fresh peak season berries. And boy, am I glad I dialed back the sugar by almost two-thirds, because it needs nothing more. I added lemon juice because it makes strawberries sing. And then, because I already knew that the dumpling recipe I'd used previously was perfect in every way, less wet and using less baking powder than the gourmet version, I decided to not fix what wasn't broken. The end result, a hole-in-one recipe and an awesome weekday night treat. Or maybe breakfast when I come at it with some Greek yogurt tomorrow morning. Ah, is it tomorrow yet? This serves six in theory. You'll need 1 quart, about 2 pints or 4 cups or 1.5 pounds, or just shy of 600 grams of strawberries, trimmed and thickly sliced, about 4 cups. 1/4 cup sugar, though I might try this with brown sugar next time, just up the cozy quotient. A juice of 1/2 lemon, 1 cup of unbleached all-purpose flour, 1.5 teaspoons of baking powder, pinch of salt, 1/2 cup of whole milk, 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter, and the accompaniment, heavy cream. You're going to stir together the strawberries, sugar, and lemon in a 4-quart heavy saucepan and let it stand, stirring occasionally until juicy, about 15 minutes. Bring to a simmer over medium heat, stirring occasionally. Stir the flour, baking powder, and salt together, and then heat the milk and butter together just until the butter melts. Stir this warmed milk mixture into the flour mixture with a wooden spoon until incorporated and smooth. Gather a golf ball sized portion of the dumpling batter onto a small spoon, and then push the dumpling into the stew using a second spoon. I used a small cookie scoop for this, a number 70, and it made 16 dumplings. Yep, I counted because someone always asks these things. Cover the fruit with the dumplings, leaving about 1/4 inch between each. Tightly cover the saucepan and reduce the heat to low. Cook undisturbed until the dumpling looks dry on top. That'll be about 15 to 18 minutes. The dumplings will have doubled in size. Let stand off the heat, uncovered for 5 minutes, and then drizzle with heavy cream right before serving. This dish definitely tastes best freshly made, as the dumplings do dry out a bit by the second. But then it starts to taste like a cobbler, and really, who's going to complain about that? Next, we're back to theblindcook.com. Christine Ha tries MasterChef Season 9 finalist Cesar Cano's tacos. I confess, I haven't followed MasterChef since Season 4, and I only followed that season because I was blogging for TV Guide. But once in a while, I'm told of a contestant that I should watch. For the latest season of MasterChef, Season 9, it was Cesar Cano, an English teacher and fellow Houstonian of Mexican heritage. I tuned into the finale and found Cesar likable and his culinary creations, according to the Hubs, aesthetically beautiful. So naturally, I reached out to Cesar and invited him to do a video on my YouTube channel. What resulted is the above episode of Christine Tries, in which I try Cesar's tacos in the private setting of his own home. I met his mom and sister, who dutifully helped out in the kitchen. We had shots of tequila before digging in, and I do declare Cesar's tacos, especially his scratch pad tortillas, are dang delicious. Gracias, Cesar, for inviting the hubs and me into your home and feeding us some fine tacos. I appreciate how the food was elevated yet accessible, the setting intimate and casual, and learning what Cesar Cano is doing in the culinary world by following him on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. For more of my YouTube videos, visit my Christine Ha channel. Now from Smitten Kitchen, here's a recipe for zucchini bread pancakes. Zucchini is pesky. It's not like tomatoes, which are the prom queens of the summer farms. Perfect no matter how you dice, slow roast, scallop, or sauce them. I never have enough tomatoes, and they're usually gone for the year before I am done with them. The same can rarely be said for zucchini. It can be a little slippery when cooked, weepy when it's raw. It's hard to get it roasted or grilled to a crisp. Sure, it's good battered and deep fried, but I have a theory that my rainbow flip-flop would be too. I'm not going to test it though, but I'm sure you understand. So when I find a zucchini that limits its less redeemable characteristics, I get a little shouty about it and demand that you cook it too. Things like quick, crunchy side dishes, herbed potato torts, goat cheese pizza, pasta salads tangled with basil spaghetti, carpaccioed, slawed, kebabbed, galetted, and frittered. And all these recipes are on smittenkitchen.com. And cake. It's a good time to get yourself reacquainted with zucchini bread. I did this a few weeks ago when the zucchini I'd tried to ignore in the fridge started to look like it was on its way out, and I had to stop being passive-aggressive about it. I'm not fond of sliced cake for breakfast. It seems better suited to an afternoon treat, and as is often in the case, it was a toddler with his ridiculous weekend breakfast demands, "I want pancakes," that got me to trying to figure out how I could make him happy while also convincing myself I wasn't just feeding him junk. If carrot cake can be pancakes, why not zucchini bread? The result is my new favorite pancake. I know I always call things my new favorite, but this is. We've made them 3 times in 3 weeks, and I have a batch in the freezer for another weekend morning. They're plush inside with a lightly crisp edge. They smell heavenly. They reheat wonderfully, and they take well to whole wheat flours and a bare minimum of sugar, and they're cinched to throw together. And they should totally be on your table this weekend. Here's the recipe for zucchini bread pancakes. The awesomest topping that you could make for these pancakes is the lightly sweetened one in the carrot cake pancakes. They're also good with syrup, maple or golden, or honey. However, I use this muddled thing I do when I feel like I should be putting something healthy on top of my pancakes, but I really just want maple syrup, which is a mixture of 1 tablespoon of maple syrup to 3 tablespoons of plain Greek yogurt. Everyone wins, right? A couple of pancake overarching theories. Thin pancake batters make large puddles of flatter pancakes that are harder to manage, but cook quickly and always cook through. Thicker pancake batters make taller pancakes that take on crisp edges and tender insides. They're my favorite. But they also don't always cook through 100% on the stove. To ensure that they're all cooked through when you serve them, it's good to keep them in a warm oven for about 10 minutes before serving. The advantage of this, of course, is that all the pancakes are warm when you're ready to put them on the table. You can also keep pancakes warm in the same oven until everyone's ready to eat. I keep the sugar level really low in pancakes because we love a sweet topping on ours, and I love the contrast between unsweetened and sweet and any baked good. If you're someone who doesn't like maple syrup or anything sticky or sweet on top of your pancakes, gasp, you might want another spoonful of sugar inside of your pancakes. This makes 10 to 12 pancakes. You'll need 2 large eggs, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 tablespoons of light brown, dark brown or granulated sugar, 1/4 cup buttermilk or 2 tablespoons each of milk and plain yogurt, whisked until smooth, 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 2 cups of shredded zucchini from about 9 ounces of whole or 1.5 medium zucchini. Heaping cups are fine. You'll need 1 cup of all-purpose flour. Half can seamlessly be swapped with a whole wheat flour. 1/4 teaspoon of table salt, 1 teaspoon of baking soda, 1 teaspoon of ground cinnamon, 1/8 teaspoon of ground or freshly grated nutmeg, butter or oil for coating the skillet. In a large bowl, you're going to combine your eggs, olive oil, sugar, buttermilk, and vanilla until smooth. Stir in the zucchini shreds, and in a smaller bowl, whisk together the flour, salt, baking soda, cinnamon, and nutmeg. Stir the dry ingredients into the zucchini batter, mixing until just combined. Preheat your oven to 200 degrees Fahrenheit and place a tray, foil-lined if you're into doing fewer dishes later, on a middle rack. Heat a large, heavy skillet, my favorite for pancakes is a cast iron, over medium heat. Once it's hot, you're going to melt a pat of butter in the pan and swirl it around until it sizzles. And then scoop scant 1/4 cup dollops of batter, mine were about 3 tablespoons each, into the pan so that the puddles do not touch. Cook until bubbles appear on the surface, about 2 to 3 minutes, and then flip the pancakes and cook for another minute or two until golden underneath. Transfer the pancakes to a prepared pan to keep warm, as well as ensure that they're all cooked through when they're served, and repeat with the remaining batter and serve warm, and then repeat next weekend. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff. My name is Gretchen Miller.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.